It's time for three stories you should know. And don't touch that dial because we're going to start by talking about the Republican tax plan. I'm serious. Don't worry. I promise. You're going to like this. I'm joined by sports writer Patrick Ruby via Skype. Hello, Patrick.
How you doing?
And by Sports Illustrated's Joan Neeson. Welcome, Joan.
Thanks for having me.
Patrick, we're going to let you go first. Off you go.
Okay, so I'm the one who actually wants to talk about the Republican tax plan. Buried in that blizzard of corporate giveaways and trickle-down economic fantasy is one tiny silver lining. As of now, the legislation is supposed to eliminate the current law that allows college sports boosters to take an 80% deduction on their quote-unquote donations that they make to athletic departments in order to have the right to purchase football and basketball season tickets. Now, look, the dirty little non-secret of big-time college sports, and this is an industry worth more than $10 billion a year, by the way, is that so much of it is not taxed because it's considered educational. Now, I think this is all great and overdue, but there's one problem here. Lawmakers have tried to eliminate these deductions and loopholes before, and it's never happened because colleges are a very powerful special interest, and so are boosters. And all you have to do is go back to the 1980s. Back then, they actually tried to get rid of this ticket deduction loophole, but they left it in for the University of Texas and for LSU because the congressmen from those two states were clever enough to slip in some language. So what happened the next year? All the other schools went to Congress, and instead of denying the break to those two schools, they gave the break to all of them. So sadly, I am not optimistic this change is going to survive, whatever final reconciliation we see on this tax bill.
Yeah, I think that this just doesn't jive with generally what we're seeing. As I was reading about this, before I even got into sort of the meat of the subject, this isn't what I would think. I would think the opposite. I would think this is very Trumpian and they would want this in there.
Very Trumpian indeed. Patrick, I'm going to suggest that even if this terrible attack against football fans who would give great deals of money for the opportunity to sit in good seats, even if this attack survives, I don't think they really have to worry because they'll still be able to deduct all the money that they spend on their private airplanes. And, you know, what you lose on the slide, you make up on the wheel. Everybody knows that. Patrick, am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong because the overall bill is definitely going to favor them. But in this case, I do think the athletic departments do have something to worry about because it will impact the amount of money they're collecting. On the other hand, they're collecting so much money that I think they'll still be fine. And on top of that, they're pretty creative. I think they'll find other ways to make up the difference if this actually happens.
Joan, I'm going to turn things over to you and hope that you dig us out of this pit of politics.
Mostly out of the pit, but we're still, I think, in a pit with my story. I'm going to focus on last Sunday. You know, those of you who are maybe traveling for Thanksgiving might have missed an entire sort of eruption in the world of college football. Sunday afternoon, Tennessee announced it was set to hire Greg Schiano, currently Ohio State's defensive coordinator, to be its new head coach. Schiano, from 1990 to 95, worked at Penn State. And then since then, he's had various jobs. He was the head coach at Rutgers. He coached the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. But in 2015, during kind of the fallout and the continued legal actions surrounding the Jerry Sandusky scandal, former Penn State assistant coach Mike McQuarrie named Schiano in a deposition about the scandal, alleging that Schiano had witnessed Sandusky abusing a boy, that he'd reported it to another coach. Schiano came out and said he had no knowledge of any of the abuse. So when Tennessee announced that it had signed a memorandum of understanding with him, Knoxville erupted. Fans were protesting. It was a bit of a mob scene. Some fans took to writing a pretty explicit message on a large rock about Schiano's reputation and his role in the scandal. It wasn't a very good look in Knoxville. And with hours, Tennessee's athletic director, John Curry, who was let go Friday morning, backed out of the hire. Neither side looked very good. Fans, like I said, it was something of a mob scene there. They were impugning a coach's reputation when likely they were probably just more concerned about the fact that Schiano hasn't had the greatest coaching record. But they used the Penn State as kind of their hook. And the athletic department looked pretty weak and indecisive and a little bit out of touch, having not really gauged a notoriously hostile fan base's sentiment before hiring a somewhat controversial coach.
First of all, to me, it seems kind of crazy that Tennessee, which is like sort of a Power Five school and a traditional football power, even if they haven't been that great lately, didn't have some sort of better plan in place. Usually that's the case. Usually it's like hiring and firing a lot of industries. If you're letting someone go, you already have like four or five people in mind that you want to come in. And in this case, maybe they did want Schiano, but they certainly didn't seem to vet him well enough, A, in terms of the Sandusky stuff, and B, in terms of just putting out a trial balloon or something with your fans to like get a sense of if they would accept this person or not. To me, that's just sort of the PR 101 side of running an athletic department.
Without coming down on one side or the other of this, Joan, I'm curious about what you think about something that Patrick said. Should athletic departments have to offer up a trial balloon to college football fans before they make a hire?
You know, that's a great question. And I think in 2017, we kind of accept that, yes, that's what they do. Should that be the case? Maybe not. I don't really know that the average fan should have kind of that level of say. But that's pretty common practice, especially at a place like Tennessee, where this is a fan base that is at times somewhat volatile. I mean, they have pushed some coaches out. They have Konzo Martin, for instance. You know, he took the team really far in the tournament, the basketball team, several years ago, and was basically sort of pushed out of Knoxville. This is a fan base with some pretty high, some might say unreasonably high standards.
All right. I think it's time to talk about Maya Moore. Actually, it's been time to talk about Maya Moore for a great long time. On October 4th, she led the Minnesota Lynx, the WNBA team for which she plays, to their fourth championship in 7 years. She's also helped teams win two Olympic medals. She's won championships in Spain. She's won basketball championships in China as well. If you put all her rings together, including the ones that she won at UConn, she would need at least a couple of more fingers in order to display them all. She was named Sports Illustrated's Performer of the Year this week, and good on SI for doing it. I'm wondering if the two of you think that the Performer of the Year designation and the fact that the ceremony for Performer of the Year is going to be on TV for the first time on Tuesday night will focus more attention not only on this very deserving athlete, but on women's sports in general and on the WNBA in particular. Patrick?
You know, I hope so. Maya Moore especially could use a lot of attention, you know, both on and off the court. Whether that really lasts or not, I'm not sure. I mean, one, we're in such a short attention span society as it is. And two, you know, traditionally, there hasn't been a lot of attention on the WNBA, on women's sports. But, you know, it has to start somewhere. So maybe this is the kind of thing that can kind of get the ball rolling a little bit, get the rock rolling down the hill, so to speak. But gosh, like I said, this day and age, I just don't know if anything keeps anyone's attention more than 5 minutes. Has Trump tweeted since I started talking?
Almost certainly. Joan, you're working for Sports Illustrated. Did you have a vote?
I did not. I honestly don't exactly know how some of these things are determined. So I did not have any say. I was really happy to see that outcome, though. I lived in Minnesota for my first job. I covered the NBA, the Timberwolves, for Fox Sports. And while I was there, I freelanced a story for Grantland when it existed about Maya Moore and sort of about, you know, she was pretty fresh out of UConn at that point. She was still kind of a phenomenon. And one of the premises of the story was, will she last as that? And it's really cool to see now, 5 years later, that people are still viewing her as a transformative player when she's so far from those championships at UConn.
Well, I would just like to close by saying hooray for this recognition for both the player and the league, because I remember the days when the only time you could count on Sports Illustrated to feature a woman or women, actually, was when the swimsuit issue came out. And I hope that this is evidence that, you know, Sports Illustrated has kind of found its way over the years. What do you think?
I know we have several people on staff who actually have a real passion for women's basketball. And that's been something, especially women's college basketball, that I think we've tried to do a better job with in recent years. And I hope we have. I haven't been involved in that coverage, but I know women's basketball has been something that we've really tried to push.
And that's great. I'm happy to see it. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been sports writer Patrick Ruby and Sports Illustrated's Joan Neeson. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
About a decade ago, photographer Jim Harrington set out to find legendary Italian climber Riccardo Cassin.
The communication was all very spotty, and it was all kind of espionage-like. Maybe I would get the phone number of an alpine club in Europe or some kind of shaky contact in Poland. Call Nico at 2 a.m. and he'll give you the phone number that you then call.
Did he find him? That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.